Good evening. I am Joaquim Pissarro, and I'm a curator in the Painting and Sculpture Department here at the Museum of Modern Art. Before I begin, I would just like to say that the person who is the noble person is sitting to my left, Stephanie, is here to interpret in sign language the contents of these talks, the conversation tonight. So if any of you needs to have access to sign language, I suggest that you can come and get some of the seats in the front, which are still available, okay? It is a distinct honor and a true pleasure for me to introduce tonight to you Jeff Koons, an artist who, in fact, needs no introduction, so I will keep my words very, very short. Jeff was born in Pennsylvania in 1955, another artist, major artist, whom Jeff feels particular affinity, was also born in Pennsylvania, and that is Warhol himself. Jeff Koons received his BFA from the Maryland Institute College of Art in 1976, and ever since has pretty much been living and working in New York City, with the exception of certain moments, certain times during which he lived and worked in Europe. Jeff, you all know this, is an artist who has received enormous international acclaim and toward whose work no artist alive today can ignore or not respond, and I will actually perhaps bring up some of this during our conversation. His work is represented in every major institution, every major museum of modern art and contemporary art in the world. All the three major New York institutions, this one, of course, but as well as the Whitney and the Guggenheim, own important works by Jeff. In this country, the National Gallery of Art, the Hirshhorn, SF MoMA, the Eli Broad Family Foundation in Santa Monica, not to be missed if you're a fan of Jeff Koons' work, among others, all own important works as well, as do other key international institutions such as Tate Modern, the Stedelijk in Amsterdam, the Ludwig Museum in Cologne, the Metropolitan Museum in Tokyo, among scores of others. Jeff's art has perhaps obtained the highest visibility, though, through a major public art project, his monumental and well-known floral sculpture known as Puppy, which some of you may have seen shown at the Rockefeller Center. Some others may have seen it where it is permanently installed in front of the Guggenheim Bilbao in the Basque country, the northwest part of Spain. If you haven't been there, it's well worth taking a trip to Bilbao just to see Puppy. Finally, I would like to emphasize maybe a lesser-known aspect of Jeff's multifarious and very rich and fecund career, that is his role as an educator. Jeff is well-known for his generous acceptance to speak in public, as we'll benefit from this to today. But in 1999, he received a major award for educating children through the visual arts, and that was the Art Start for Children Award. Given that this event is placed under the aegis of the Education Department, I thought it would be worth mentioning this. So, without further ado, please join me in welcoming Jeff Koons. Thank you.
Joaquim did quite an introduction there. That was really wonderful. But, you know, it's really an honor to be here at the Modern. Years ago, when I came to New York after graduating from art school, my first job was here at the Modern. And the Modern had such an impact on me, being able to study the collection every day, to go through the galleries and come to the education department and see the films by Duchamp and Man Ray, and to follow everything in the project gallery. So, you know, it's really nice. And the Modern's always had a very special place, you know, in my heart. But my work really is based a lot from the collection. But we'll start. When I moved to New York, I was always a painter. And I always studied to be a painter from the time that I was a child. I started taking art lessons when I was probably about 7 years old. And the only thing I was really prepared to do was to be an artist. I wasn't prepared for anything else. I had my liberal arts background to go to college, but I spent all my time in the art class. And so I'm really fortunate that when I got to art school, because I had no understanding of what art could be, that I ended up in this profession that really can be a hub to all the disciplines in the world. And that I found this vehicle, because I had no idea what I was involved with, and I really don't today, but because art always transforms. But here was this vehicle that would connect theology and philosophy and sociology with physics and aesthetics, you know, just with, you know, kind of subjective dreams. And so it's wonderful every day to participate in this dialogue. When I got here, I stopped having interest in painting because I felt that it was too subjective. I always loved Dada and surrealism, but I really wanted more from my work. I wanted to connect with my generation and to make work that you know, was about things outside myself, not just about myself. So this is a piece called Inflatable Bunny with Inflatable Flower. And when I made this, I just would go out and buy these ready-made objects, very influenced by Duchamp and Robert Smithson. And, you know, I love different connections in art history because it feels a connection to humanity that way. But I felt within these pieces, though, that it was revealing a little bit too much of my own sexuality, the bright color. As time goes on, I come back and I like that aspect in the work. So working here at the Modern and seeing a lot of the ready-mades and the design and architecture department, I started to make these works. This is my first Hoover, and it's called Hoover Celebrity 3. But the work's infringed upon, and there's actually bolts that go through the back of the vacuum cleaner. And so they're really being displayed, not in kind of any unique way. They're really actually quite, you know, in a modernist tradition, kind of a Mondrian background. And this was... So I felt that I wasn't really contributing to a Duchampian tradition. So I decided that I didn't want to infringe upon these objects. I didn't want to fight gravity. I didn't want to, you know, put a bolt through them or crazy glue something to another surface. So I just started to encase them. And I would display them really in a Renaissance type manner of sculpture. This is like an Eternal Virgin. So, and this is displaying its newness. It's a new Hoover convertible. And I would take it out of the box, keep everything clean and pristine, and put it inside this commercial kind of display situation, and it would just display its newness. This is a double-decker, a displaced double-decker, and, you know, kind of following the kind of the pop tradition of more is better. But I also like the type of vocabulary that would happen between the objects. They would start to develop like family relationships or, you know, kind of male-female relationships to each other. So the way they would communicate back and forth. The top vacuum cleaner says wet dry at the top. It's a vacuum cleaner that you would use to also pick up liquids. But I also enjoyed Kierkegaard and Sartre and either or being a nothingness. So when I make my tanks, I think that they relate a lot to the wet dry and the being a nothingness. After making the new, there was a time when my work really didn't have a lot of support in New York. So I had to really turn to have a profession that I could make enough money to produce my own works. The vacuum cleaner pieces would cost me about $3,000 each to make. So I ended up working on Wall Street, selling commodities and stocks and bonds, but I specialized in cotton. And I did that, and I ended up producing a body of work then called Equilibrium. And I was independent then of really looking for collectors or I really wanted to be independent with my work where I wasn't reliant on anybody. So in 85, I made a body of work called Equilibrium, and I wanted it to be more kind of masculine not because people would think of the vacuum cleaners as the feminine housewife in the 50s, and I wanted to show kind of a darker side of consumerism, kind of more male-oriented and more biological. One ball equilibrium tank, to me, is very womb-like, and it's an ultimate state of being. All the forces are equal. It's equilibrium, and it's a pre-birth. It's a pre-new. I wanted the viewer to desire that, and I also wanted them to hear the sirens telling them to go for equilibrium in this exhibition. And this was Dr. Dunkenstein, and Dr. Dunkenstein was a siren in the equilibrium show that would basically kind of be like a star there saying, you know, I've achieved equilibrium, you know, go for it. And here he is with a basketball that's exactly divided in half. It's a Nike poster. I also go on and I make these 50-50 tanks where exactly half the ball is submerged and half's above the water. And Ed Paschke, a teacher that I had and a friend, Ed always told me that everything's already here in this world. And you just have to look for it. And my experience in art has always been one of just opening myself up to my environment and trying to keep everything in play. And I would just find that I could develop a narrative in between different objects, different images or ready-mades. This was a tool for equilibrium. So I had a tank that if you desired it, an ultimate state of being, a siren telling you to go for it, and then a tool was like the aqualung. And it was cast in bronze, and if you put the aqualung on to go for it, it would take you under and, you know, probably drown you. But if you were able to get the aqualung off your back and resurface and think you found salvation, there would be a lifeboat there, but it was made of bronze and would take you right back down. And I think that I was trying to say that white middle-class artists were using art for social mobility the way other ethnic groups have used sports for social mobility. And, you know, all these sirens kind of faking it like we've achieved something. And one of them could have been me. One of them could have been Polka. It could have been Julian. Could have been any artist. But we were really artists instead of the basketball players there as the sirens. This is a 50-50 tank. It's back to that wet-dry, either-or. You know, due to vibration and even the sun will move these basketballs from one end of the tank to the other. And when that happens, there's different communication that takes place. I always think of a three-ball 50-50 tank like the beginning of a thought pattern because it's like an artificial intelligence. The balls are in this location right now, but, you know, 3 hours from now, they could all be grouped over on this side or, you know, two could be over here and this one here. This is Akie Bacardi. After Equilibrium, I did a show called Luxury Degradation. And this is 1986, and I wanted to work in a new material. And I was walking down Fifth Avenue, and I saw a ready-made Jim Beam decanter train. And I thought, you know, this would be a wonderful object to transform and put into a different material. And when I started to think about this and incorporating into a work of art, I started to just look at the advertising and the things that caught my interest. You know, I think the only thing that an artist can do is, you know, follow their interest and focus on that interest. And that's really the only thing that you can do. And if you do that, things become quite kind of metaphysical. So when I started to notice that advertising targets people at their income level and uses different levels of abstraction on the viewer. So I associated that with objects and I put them in stainless steel. I wanted to work with an intoxicating material. You bring it to a polished surface and, you know, the room can be upside down. Things become disorienting. And it's a fake luxury. It's not a real luxury. It's not silver. It's not platinum. You know, you could. It's what pots and pans are made out of. And so it's proletarian. But this was how advertising is directed at $10,000 income and lower in 1986. And the form of abstraction was really like, you know, take your weekly paycheck and gamble and take things as they come. And you know, maybe just like some subliminal seduction could be in the ice cubes or something, but it's really just the abstraction of gambling. A lesser economic object was my Fisherman Golfer, which is a bar toolkit. Everything in luxury degradation is based on alcohol, because it's based on basically that advertising and society wants you to pull yourself up by your bootstraps and to make as much economic and political wealth as you can. But at the same time, they're setting you up to debase you and to take all that wealth and power source. And they do that through, you know, having degradation come in and through the pursuit of luxury. And so we're kind of paralleling the alcoholic and the demise of the alcoholic here. As the alcoholic becomes more and more dependent and more involved in abstraction, as we move up economically, we're becoming more and more dependent on the pursuit of luxury and being hit with heavier doses of abstraction. This is the Jim Beam J.B. Turner train. It's 7/5 of Jim Beam bourbon. And when I saw it, I thought, oh, this is a great Duchampian object. How can I transform it and maintain its soul? Because the alcohol is the soul. And so I realized, you know, I'll take it to a foundry. I'll recast the porcelain and the plastic into stainless steel. And I wanted this proletarian intoxicating material. And it turned out that stainless steel was the only thing that would preserve the alcohol. That's what they use in the piping at the distilleries and in the vats. So if you lift off the smokestack of the engine, right there is the tack stamp seal. And that's the interface to the soul. If you slide open the door of the baggage car or lift up the log of the log car, you'll see the tack stamp seal. And again, that's the interface. I always thought if somebody wanted kind of a lesson, 101 in art abstraction, you'd just break the seal and drink the liquor. But it would be ruined as a work of art. As we're moving up economically, the train represented the middle class in the luxury degradation. As we're moving up economically, we're around $35,000 income in 1986. I took a train ride from the Bronx and from Harlem and from lower class income areas to Grand Central Station, where in New York they hit their highest economically based audience. And so here, now we start to have abstraction where bottles are going through glasses and, you know, the bottles cutting through space like the train through space. And all the paintings babbled like the babble of an alcoholic. Maybe one's a Kia Bacardi and another one's, you know, come through with taste, quote Newsweek. Another one, I could go for something Gordon's. And at the highest end of the economic level, I showed the Baccarat crystal set, which was originally a glass Baccarat set that I cast in stainless steel, brought to a mirror finish, and polished it. Several of these pieces that I'd look and show tonight are in the Moderns collection. This is one. And at the highest income level, $45,000 and up income level in 1986, was Frangelica, Stay In Tonight. And this is just like a wave of liquor. You know, it's sexualized if you look at the wave. And somebody's just kind of lost in their own thought pattern. They don't even communicate socially anymore. After luxury degradation, I continued to work in stainless steel. And I did an exhibition, a group show at the Sonnabend Gallery. And it was kind of referred to as like Neo Geo because there were four artists, myself, Peter Holly, Ashley Binkerton, and Meyer Weissman. And I showed a group of 10 works there. And I really wanted to show what the freedoms that artists used since the time of around the French Revolution, of when artists stopped working for the direct patronage of the church, or where they could really make anything that they kind of wanted to, how they used this freedom. But Bob Hope was there, really a symbol of art in the hands of the masses. And I never thought Bob Hope would tell a joke because he subjectively, you know, thought that it was funny. You know, he would choose a joke that the night before got the biggest laugh to come out with the next evening. And on the other side of kind of this panoramic view, I had Louis XIV. And Louis was a symbol that if you put art in the hands of a mass, if you put art in the hands of a monarch, that you know, eventually it would reflect their ego and become decorative. And it was the same with the Bob Hope, that if you gave art to the masses, it eventually would reflect mass ego and become decorative. The whole time I was alluding that if you would give art to Jeff Koons, eventually it'll become reflective of my ego and decorative. Eventually this is what happens. The rabbit was one of the objects in that exhibition. And I really wanted to show with the rabbit, that was artist fantasy, you know, like Dali. But I wanted to show my own history of working with the ready-made. In this Neo Geo show, a lot of people, it was a new audience for me. Ileana Sonneben, it was a more international gallery. People weren't familiar with my inflatables, and I wanted to show my history back to that first image that we looked at, the inflatable bunny and flower. And if the rabbit's iconic, I think that it's because of the, you know, the many different layers that it has, the different polarities that it has. You can look at it, and it can be a symbol of resurrection, Easter. Where I grew up in Pennsylvania, people would always put these out in their yard at Easter time. Or it could be a symbol of Playboy, the Playboy bunny. It could be like an orator. You know, right here, the microphone to my mouth right now, the carrot, it's like an orator. It's like a masturbator with the carrot to the mouth. And I love to also look at the rabbit compared to the Venus of Wellendorf because they're very, very similar. And they share a lot of similar attributes. If you think of the Venus, you know, she has these tiny little hands. Look at the size of the hands of the rabbit. And she has a big round head. She actually tilts down towards this one breast more, and that's where the carrot is. Her mass, the largest mass is in the body, but with the larger legs. And she has pleats in her hair. The rabbit has the pleats in the ears. So after working with statuary, end of 86, beginning of 87, I was invited to be in a show in Munster, Germany. Kaspar Koenig, once every 10 years, does a show called Munster. I think it's happening this year. And it was a big sculpture show. And for me, a young artist just starting to show internationally, it was really important to me to be in this exhibition. So I decided that I would go to Munster. It was to make a site-specific work. And I saw this Kippen Curl in the town square. And the community really got a sense of their being from there, their self-confidence from this Kippen Curl. It showed that they were independent, they were agrarian-based. And I thought I'll take this bronze sculpture, which was in their town square, and I'd recast it in stainless steel because I thought people's needs were being met a different way, as kind of a sense of economic needs. And when I made the Kippen Curl, and we cast it, we made a mold on it, and I cast it in stainless steel. When they brought it, these sections out of the foundry, they banged it up against the wall before it was cooled. And because of that, it bent one arm and it twisted another leg. And it really became my Humpty Dumpty. My rabbit's ear was 3 inches too short and it was a fiasco. And so I had to decide whether I was going to pull out of this exhibition or whether I was going to give the piece radical plastic surgery. And up to this point, everything was, you know, the preservation of every perfection and imperfection of an object. Everything we've looked at has been a ready-made, whether it's a basketball, whether it's a vacuum cleaner. Bob Hope was a ready-made that I cast and put into a different material. But if you lift him up and look underneath, every little bump on that original plaster is right there. And the paintings were... that we looked at, they were from ready-made plates for the actual advertisements that were used in the streets. I printed them on canvas. But this type of detail to the ready-made, I was really going to be changing there. And I went for the radical plastic surgery. We brought in some really great steel workers, and they would heat it up till it's white hot and bang, 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 bend it, stretch a leg, bang, 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 bend an arm. And in doing so, it completely liberated me. And I never worked with a ready-made object again until maybe about, 5 years ago. So everything from this point now is not a ready-made. It looks like a ready-made, but It just comes from a collaging of different images that I've seen, or changing different scales, but no actual image or model like this existed. I did it. This show was Banality, and Banality's 1988, and a lot of the factories or foundries I was working with started to become so complicated for me to get the works through. I decided I'll just go to Europe and I'll work in different materials. So I decided I wanted to work in wood and porcelain. And I chose wood for the spiritual quality. The church has used art, and I really learned to really love the Baroque and the Rococo, the type of equilibrium that the Baroque and the Rococo create. And so this is a piece, Ushering in Banality. I thought it's kind of autobiographical. I always thought of myself kind of back there pushing the pig, and that I was going to usher in Banality. It didn't really matter what people thought, because I felt that, you know, there's just kind of like a positive force on my side. I kind of have different images of spirituality in the Banality show, because I felt that people needed the confidence of kind of authoritarian, kind of theological type of figures sometimes, for them to be able to let go and to go with Banality. And Banality was a symbol of self-acceptance. I was really dealing with people's cultural guilt and shame, and I was using the metaphor of masturbation for this cultural guilt and shame people have of their own history. That's how, people can either be debased through art, or they can be empowered. And I was trying to work in a vocabulary of empowerment, that the viewer, whatever their cultural history was, that it was perfect. There was no judgment against them. And so children learn about their bodies in the bathtub. So, and this is a reference like the urinal and Duchamp and everything, and kind of victimizer. But one of the main powers of a woman in the tub deals with the bathtub and that experience of learning about one's body as a child. This is the Pink Panther, another reference to masturbation. I would always say I didn't know what she'd be doing with the Pink Panther other than taking it home to masturbate with. He looks kind of a little bit dazed, alarmed. But porcelain is a material that was, you know, it came from the king's kitchen. I mean, it was an aristocratic material. Today it's completely democratized material. And so, you know, we can all have porcelain. And so this was, again, a dialogue of just about trying to function objectively. And porcelain shrinks in the oven. It shrinks 19%, so it's a sexualized material because it remains kind of very tight in its surface. Michael Jackson in Bubbles was there as the Pieta. You know, it's just a reference to Renaissance sculpture, and was there also as a spiritual figure that, you know, it's all right, you know, to go with Banality. I had St. John the Baptist there. I had Buster Keaton was from The General, was like entering Christ entering Jerusalem. And it was also to show the type of reverence that we give to a pop star today as, you know, equal to what we would give in the past theologically to people. Or the attention we would give in theology to people. This was Baron Policeman. Baron Policeman is that Michael Jackson's a porcelain. This is a wooden sculpture. Baron Policeman's over 7 feet tall. And I always thought it's a piece that's a little bit about Hitler. And the bear seems to be sexually toying with authority, about ready to blow its whistle. And, I felt that in Banality I was trying to rally artists to embrace the powers of communication. You know, even though people made, you know, wonderful works and really communicating in the 70s and 80s. But there were certain times where a dialogue was almost like, you know, manipulate somebody? No, how terrible that would be. And I was trying to have a dialogue that, you know, these tools to the power of art to present something, you know, we should use all these tools, the tools of advertising or of communication, of manipulation, manipulation, but that morality, you know, comes along with that. So you just have to be conscious of you know, your interaction with your community. After the Benality show, I remember I was invited to be in a show at the Whitney Museum. It was a show called Image World, and it involved things from the media. And so I decided that I would make a billboard, and I would incorporate this woman. I remember seeing in a magazine, I used her dress in Fate de Verre, Ilona Staller, Cicciolina. She was a porn star that was elected into Italian parliament. And I thought, I'll hire her as a model, and I'll just put myself into her kind of sets, into her photographs, into her kind of pornographic sets. And I'll just make it like we're making a film, and I'll call it Made in Heaven, starring Jeff Koons and Cicciolina. And so I hired her, I went out, I made this billboard, and we started to flirt with each other when we were there. You know, I found her very attractive, a very beautiful woman, and a person with really two personalities. You know, Ilona is this person that can be very, very sweet, and also somebody then that can be very transgressive. And I actually was kind of walking the talk. I accepted her history. You know, her cultural history was perfect. Oh, you were a porn star? That's all right. You know, so it was more about, you know, just the moment and the future. Well, that's what has to kind of be different, but that one's past is perfect, you know, and transcendence, you know, can happen. This was kind of my vision of Made in Heaven. It really comes from also seeing Masaccio's The Expulsion. Again, this metaphor of guilt and shame is now the guilt and shame of the body and of the close-up of the body. This is a takeoff of like Canova's Kiss, and I'm very proud of it because of the way I was able to bring the bodies down in a very broke tradition, but to cut them and have no sense of violence at the base. It's very heart-like. This is a large vase of flowers, and so the Benality show was a little bit like the Garden of Eden, and also the Made in Heaven show's reference to the Garden of Eden and fertility. And I always thought of a large vase of flowers also could be like 50 assholes, you know. But it's, you know, it's also, it's just this kind of very sexualized, a lot of fertility. This is the painting, Ilona's Asshole. And it's one of my favorite paintings that I've ever made. And because of the type of confidence and self-trust, you know, to show your asshole and the pimples on your asshole. And but if you look at the image, it's just procreation, and it's just, you know, it's like a hummingbird pollinating. It's like a bee pollinating. It's nature. It's survival of the species. And so, again, this sense of, you know, kind of trusting in the self and accepting oneself. This is another painting. These are large silkscreen paintings. This is called Manet. And it's a takeoff of Manet. I remember watching a program on TV, and it showed every artist, Picasso, and everybody who made artworks in reference to Manet. And I remember at the end of the program just looking over at my wife and saying, I made one too, and feeling that connection that, yeah, I did Manet. And but if you look at the water in the background, it's just like in the center of the Manet painting, that water coming down. After the Made in Heaven show, I made a piece called Puppy, and I first showed it in 1992 in Arlesen, Germany, and I really wanted to show everything that I had learned about the Baroque and the Rococo, working on Benality, working on the Made in Heaven show, and also what my intentions of Made in Heaven were. I was attacked a lot for the show, and right here, this has all the fertility, it has all the you know, this negotiation of the Baroque and the Rococo, it's about whether you want to serve or be served. You know, you can have a pet dog and, you know, say, oh, come here, boy, and have it roll over on its stomach and show it a lot of love and scratch it. Or, you know, you can say, you know, bring me my paper, bring me my newspaper. And it's a piece that's really about control, too, just like relationships. There's 60,000 decisions there. Every plant's a decision. And at the same time, all that control in creating it, but then you walk away from it, and it's just really in nature's hands, and certain plants are going to dominate this way and take over the type of plant beside it, and other plants are going to shoot out 100 centimeters this way above the plant beside it. And that's a cycle of life, this kind of life and death. And this is a balloon dog. After the I started working on a body of work called Celebration back in the 90s, it got a little congested because it was a very ambitious product project, and that I was involved with a couple different dealers at one time. So finally it got loosened up and the pieces started to come through. This is a balloon dog. It's polished stainless steel, and it's about 12 feet long by 10 feet 4 inches high. And it's, even though it's a balloon dog, it's a little equestrian. It reminds me of a Trojan horse. This is Moon. It's like half of a Celebration balloon. It's 10 and a half feet in diameter. This is called Tulips. This is the front of a piece. They implode. These balloon tulips all implode on each other, and they create a lot of different colors in between. You can't see the stems in the back, but it's like a rainbow. This is a painting from Celebration called Play-Doh, and it consists of really millions of little shapes. There's no wet-into-wet blending. I thought that I could create a more objective painting by having everything have hard edges. And this painting's probably about 12 foot by 10 foot. This is a painting from Easy Fun Ethereal, and it's like the Mona Lisa in the background. It comes from a Chanel ad, and woman holding shoes and just dropping her out and the shoes and just leaving the hair leaves little remnants of like a Magritte internal area there in the dark where you can see through to this rotunda. You have the corn spiral there. I thought that's a little bit like the Western European American kind of avant-garde 20th century, a little Dali-like. The eye is like Man Ray. The lips are like Man Ray. It's called Lips. That's another big painting. This is called Pam. It's like Fool's House, Jasper's painting. But instead of the broom, we have a brownie. And it's swishing the other way, a little kind of transgressive in its color. And that's Pamela Anderson. And I just dropped out her shirt and just left her flesh to be a little bit like a contemporary Mona Lisa. And that's like a TV dinner in the background. This is Popeye, and a painting. It's it has the Dr. Thornton in the background, and then on top of that, I have put a lobster coming in at the top, a reference to Dali and Duchamp. I say Duchamp because of the mustache, and Liechtenstein, Popeye, Rauschenberg, the cardboard down below, the silvers like Rosenquist and Warhol. This is olive oil, and olive oil, one layer there is the outline of her. If we would drop out all the other layers, you could see her very clearly, and has Warhol Superman in there, and the background is, happens to be the harbor in South Africa. My wife's from South Africa, and so I think she's olive oil. And this is a sculpture from Popeye. And Popeye's from 2003, this work. It's a lobster. I always like this work a lot because I think you look at it and it goes back and forth. Who's the performer and who's the audience? And, you know, the lobster's masculine with the you know, the mustache tentacles and the broad arms. But if you, you know, look at him, the tail is very feminine. And it could be like a stripper with a feather ready to do the dance, you know. This is a painting called Elvis. And in this painting, I used H.C. Westerman's The Dance of Death in the background. And I made it like a panel, like a Warhol car crash, and flipped it upside down, turned it all different directions. And I used H.C. Westerman because I think of him as a subjective artist who would, you know, would participate, though, in transcendence into objective art. When he would make his self-portraits, he'd give himself this pencil bar mustache and put himself in white tails, and, you know, he became like Clark Gable. And so this transcendence into kind of like Hollywood imagery, and then this woman, when I saw her in a men's magazine, she looked just like Elvis. And I thought, you know, that's like Andy's Elvis, but she looks like Elvis, maybe Lisa Marie. But so it's more kind of a transcendence into objective art. And then the lobsters like Dalí and Duchamp, because you end up with L-H-O-O-Q with Duchamp and the mustache of the lobster. So we end up with a Mona Lisa. And it's just really kind of that, I think it's important to have an anchor in objective art. An anchor in subjective art. And H.C. Westerman always signed his pieces with the anchor. So personal iconography for an artist is really important. But transcendence into iconography, which is past the self, you know, is a much higher calling. This is where I started to work with ready-mades again, like the lobster hanging before. This is a ready-made a ladder, and then I use an inflatable and molded it, a ready-made. This is caterpillar ladder. It's like Duchamp's nude descending the staircase and Bala's little dog with the feet going like this, kind of morphed together. This is a new painting called Monkey Train. In silver paint, where you see kind of this gray, it's silver reflective aluminum paint. I have a train meeting a horse and buggy, and it's flipped like a Warhol, then coming the opposite direction. And it's showing an image of one technology replacing another one. And today, you know, both those technologies are nostalgic. And so the monkey's face really becomes a mirror of the viewer and puts us in contact with our own mortality. You know, makes a reference to Darwinism. And I also think it's very Dada because it makes a reference to Picabi as a portrait of Cézanne. And that portrait of Cézanne goes on, portrait of Renoir, portrait of Rembrandt, and it's just like everybody, the viewer, it's their portrait. This is a new painting called Hawk Elvis. So just like I did a feminine Elvis, this is a masculine Elvis. And where we see the gray, that's a reflective silver. And if you could see the space that the hawk and those dots are inside of, it's actually Led Zeppelin. It's Robert Plant's legs. Spread over on this far side over there. And Jimmy Page is over on this side with his guitar. A little bit of, it almost looks like sperm on his eye is the tip of Jimmy Page's guitar. That's a Hawk Elvis. This is a triple Hawk Elvis. And this triple Hawk Elvis has these little kind of monstrous heads in there. And they remind me of subjective art like Peter Saul or you know, art that's really about the self. And I think that, you know, we all, you know, have this aspect of the subjective. And as artists and viewers, understanders of art involved in this vocabulary, you know, you have to accept the self, or even if you're not involved in art, in anything. But you have to be able to accept the self and accept the little monsters that are within you for this transcendence. To be able to expand your parameters. And so those little monsters are just a symbol of that, kind of walking the talk again. This is a new painting called Landscape Waterfall. And that little kind of silver line drawing I like to think of as like a man walking his dog in the Swiss Alps. But it's really like a drawing like the origins of the world. And then there's a swish there. My son Kurt, who's only three, made that. And it's just such a beautiful swish. So I put that in there. And then the dots, it makes up, it's from a filter, makes up this waterfall that's from Thailand. And so it's a painting which is just, I think, I wanted to introduce into this body of work that's slightly kind of more feminine than some of the hawks, because that's kind of like a high testosterone type images, and these are a little more feminized. This is a tree from Central Park that I photographed, put in a pattern, and then put some kind of like Twombly type gestures into it. And then the yellow line drawing there, down below at the bottom, you can see kind of two rounded shapes. They're two rocks. And there's some roots down at the bottom and a tree trunk going up the center, and then the foliage wraps around it. It reminds me of that painting that we looked at earlier from Made in Heaven, the rocks and the tree trunk and the foliage wrapped around. And this is one of the new sculptures I'm working on. I'm working on other sculptures too, but this is called The Dictator. And The Dictator's a mortar cannon, Civil War cannon from 1862. And it was the biggest mortar cannon used. And this cannon really terrorized everybody. It shoots a 13-inch cannonball with holes in it, so it makes a tremendous amount of noise. And the cannonball goes 2.5 miles. And so it's a working cannon, and creating every aspect of the dictator exactly the way it was. It's been lost, but it'll weigh the exact same amount, 17,198 pounds. And everything about it will be authentic. And it's just a very, very visceral image to be around. And you can look at it, it can have some sense of castration, or it can just be kind of very powerful. That's one image. Another image that I'll show with this work we're looking at is the Liberty Bell, recreating an exact replica of the Liberty Bell, which is a more kind of, has masculine, feminine aspects to it, but tends to be a little more feminine, like Dalí's Alice in Wonderland. So I hope I didn't speak too much there, but okay. That's the.
Thank you very much, Jeff. So let me just tell you a little bit about how we're going to format the next session. I think that Jeff and I will be sitting together and engaging in a conversation, but perhaps I will be showing you, in fact, some of the images that I wanted to refer, some of which you have seen already through Jeff's wonderful talk, and then perhaps use those as props to engage in a discussion. So we will be doing this for about 25-30 minutes, and after which you will be seeing two of our colleagues descending the staircase in a very Duchampian manner with mics, and they will open the conversations to you for a Q&A session. Then that will take about 20 minutes or so. So if you wish, Jeff, we can talk there. Would you? You can all hear us?
Both of us.
Okay, great. Well, first of all, Jeff, thank you very, very much for this this great presentation. I think this was a superb short survey of a nerve that is, as you all know, can verify for those of you who may not be familiar with Jeff's work, which is incredibly prolific and diverse and rich in so many ways. Several things have struck me, if I may. I think that actually, despite or maybe because of this extraordinary diversity, there are several threads that I think unify your works. At least this is the way I perceive it. And in fact, even hearing you, actually, if I may ask you, perhaps, would it be possible to turn down a little bit those two side projectors, because I think we're a little bit dazzled here, and maybe we can look at the audience a little more. Great, thank you so much. So those unifying threads that I found, I mean, you could sense them through Jeff's talks, and there are certain terms that recur, reference to sexuality, very, very often a reference to tradition. And I'm not putting any order there, any hierarchy, but you seem to be so completely immersed in the history of art from the Renaissance onwards, and even maybe before. These are two, and I would also say, I don't want to use the word fetishistic, but I mean a very deep personal engagement, commitment to the object per se, the objectude in its directness, in its universal way of appealing or speaking to a mass of consumers. I mean, there's something about your work that is absolutely universal, simple, it's there, everybody gets it. But in fact, do they? So, I mean, I don't want to to put words in your mouth, but these seem to me to be certainly three major conduits that seem to be coming through from the 1980s up to this very moment. Would you?
Joachim, when you just mentioned about detail or this type of caring, I just realized that when I was speaking about the time of the Kipping Curl, there was something that I didn't say that I really want to state, that that experience when I felt liberated from
taking care of all the details of that object, that kip and curl that I gave the radical plastic surgery to, that I didn't have to care for every detail or imperfection of its surface, because I realized what I really cared about, the real ready-made, was the viewer. And that's why I was freed from the object. I cared about the viewer. I cared about communicating to the viewer about their perfection. And if they considered something imperfect, also the dialogue about that. But that was the ready-made that was important. And
And this, in turn, I mean, that goes along. It was fascinating for me to hear you speak so much about the viewer tonight. As I mentioned earlier on in my introduction to Jeff's talk, Jeff is truly a great educator. I mean, I only mentioned one major award, but Jeff counts several, you know, great distinctions in that capacity. And there are very few artists I can think of today, I mean, great as they may be, who are so solidly invested in the notion of educating, communicating. I mean, it seems that the presence of the viewer, that's of course a very Duchampian, Warholian thing, is very important to you. Is that right? I mean, can you comment on it?
Yeah, I think so. When I was a child, I used to go door to door, and I would sell gift wrapping paper, and I would sell, you know, candies, and I always enjoyed that. I never knew who was going to open up the door, and then I never knew, once I'd see their image, what odor was going to come out of the house, and what the decor was going to be. But I enjoyed this communication of kind of meeting each other's needs. And it's a similar thing for art. I mean, art is this thing that gives such transcendence to the artist. But at the same time, you feel the type of transcendence that you can share with the viewer. Mm-hmm. That it's not only expanding your parameters and your understanding of possibilities of life and the self, but also that this dialogue, this shared dialogue, is taking place, you know, with the viewer.
Mm-hmm. I'd never heard you mention that anecdote, but this is a perfect transition to what I want to show you, since we are, after all, at MoMA, is just review the number of the works of art that by Jeff that are certainly in the painting and sculpture collection. Okay, all right. So I'm just going to show you very briefly we own in painting and sculpture four, I believe, major works by Jeff. You've heard Jeff talk about the tank piece, which is up on view, by the way, right now on the second floor in the display that Eva Respini and I put together last summer. This major piece, which you heard Jeff discuss as well, and I'd like to come back to this in a very short while. Oops, no, we wish we owned this, but this unfortunately escaped us. We'll come back to the other pieces. I'm sorry, they're not here tonight. But anyway, let me stop with this particular piece, which was on view during the reinstallation. So is there a problem?
Well, this is true.
Take it out of our pocket? Jeff's? Okay.
Sorry.
I was very, very interested in hearing you discuss this anecdote, because you've talked a lot about this piece, the series of the Hoovers. And one of the aspects that I heard you mention before was the fact that, and this is something, we're only born a few years apart, so I mean, in the 70s, when you grew up in America or in Europe, you had a lot to do with a vacuum cleaner salesman. That was a very important figure. Today, nobody talks or nobody mentions anything about vacuum cleaner salesman. I mean, I don't know, some of you probably are wondering what I'm talking about. But this was indeed a very important social function, and the burst of the assumption of the consuming society, you know, the guy who was going knocking at the doors, as you just described, Jeff, and going meeting people who sometimes would either slam the door at his face or meet him openly and buy one of those vacuums. This was a very big thing. I was curious about your referencing to this. And the other aspect I picked up on your previous discussions of the Hoover pieces is your reference to childhood, which is another theme that I think is so paramount. It's in so many pieces.
When you mentioned about the Hoover salesman, you know, today you have the internet and you don't have this door-to-door person. But so I did enjoy that. And I also enjoyed working with products that, you know, if you would see it, you would think of me. So, you know, if you would see a Hoover, you would think of the work. If you'd see a basketball, you know, that you would think of it. But when I was a child, when I was about 4 years old, I took a vacuum cleaner and I stuck it in the toilet. And I got in a lot of trouble. And so I guess that it was kind of my way of being involved in the avant-garde or something. Oh, I'll work with a vacuum cleaner.
In a urinal, no less.
Yeah, I'll be transgressive. But I guess also when you're a child, it's just this machine that's very, very powerful that you would come across maybe playing on the ground or something. And I always liked the different... the sexuality of it. You could have both feminine and masculine aspects to it. And, you know, in art, there's a lot of forms of segregation. Many things can segregate. But sexuality is the first segregator. And so I've always have had interest in things that, you know, can really communicate equally with both sexes. And polarities. The more polarities that one thing has, you know, the fuller it is, the more emulates life.
So yeah, I've heard you also mention the referencing sexuality in reference to this particular many of your pieces, but this one in particular. And I'm glad I can maybe seize this opportunity today to ask you a question more specifically here, because I'm not sure, and forgive my innocence maybe, but which, I mean, you mentioned in somewhere, I forget where, the fact that you associate both sexual roles, genders, to the vacuum cleaners, to the Hoovers, and the male and the female. And I mean, to me, naively, I think the erect ones are probably a reference to the males, and the sort of more uterine ones, the one above, probably a reference to the female, but maybe not. And could you explain a little bit what you mean? Or am I completely out of it?
Well, no. And there are different vacuum cleaners that that kind of perform in different ways. But the ones at the bottom, you know, can also be very feminine. As I showed the one just upright, separate green one, like an eternal virgin. You know, it can be very feminine. That bag-like, which could be like a sack and kind of interpreted masculine, can also be womb-like and feminine.
So both have interchangeable roles in that sense. I see. Yeah.
And, you know, it's the same with the, I guess, the upright at the top. I mean, it's kind of, you know, very round. I guess it could be considered womb-like, but kind of masculine then with the hose. But it changes with colors. The one at the top tends to, because of the brown and the yellow, tends to be more masculine. There's another version, which is... I think an 8 gallon, which is red, which tends to be more feminine, and then a little blue, which is 5 gallon, tends to be more childlike. They take on almost like family structure.
So talking about family, let's go back a little bit and go back to this piece, which I'm absolutely fascinated by, and which Eva and I became very familiar with as we played with it, you know, mounting it on them. And it was really fascinating as we were installing this piece to experience part of what Jeff was discussing about, which is this notion of equilibrium. And again, you've all heard Jeff refer back and forth to this notion of equilibrium, which is so central, at least to the earlier part of your works, but even later on, I would think. So what you do not know, what you do not see, is that the way you see this piece photographed here is not the way it stays, because inevitably, no matter how much care our worthy colleagues from conservation come and look at it almost daily, if not weekly, you know, the three balls that are held in suspension halfway through the liquid, and by the way, how are they kept halfway through, you know, if you put a ball, a basketball, on a liquid surface, it will float. It will not sink halfway through. So I believe that the way Jeff has managed to create this oddity is by filling the ball, correct me anytime if I'm wrong, filling the basketball halfway through with water, no less, then so that the mass is exactly the same weight halfway inside the ball. And the air just keeps... Sorry, go.
Joachim, actually, I...
sorry.
I have... the outside water is one, and then inside I have water that's just a little heavier that I saturated with sodium. Oh, and the reason I did that is so the ball won't spin as much. It'll stay static.
Oh, great. Thank you for the precision. So, tricky piece to install. But what you do not see, obviously, with a photograph is you would need a sort of extremely long video to perceive this, is that gradually those balls fall off this equilibrium, and that this equilibrium never stays quite the same. There's no such thing, in other words. And this is what fascinated Eva and myself as we mounted the piece together. There's no such thing as this stasis, which is this ideal moment of equilibrium that you're striving for, perhaps, in this piece, and which the piece, in a way, escapes, there's this kind of hugging, almost in a sexual sense, by which those balls gradually gravitate towards each other. And so at the end of a week, the conservators come back and separate them again, trying to set off a new order for the following week.
So you have a 50-50 tank, that's the tank that we have. And so, it really depends on the vibration. And on a 50-50, I don't have too much vibration. The equilibrium vibration really comes into play. But even the sun, the way it makes the ions in the water move around, can push the balls. Mm-hmm. So wherever it's installed. But you're absolutely right there. I wanted to achieve permanent equilibrium. I wanted these pieces to not have such maintenance problems. But at the same time, I wanted to keep them very, very pure. And I could have worked with different oils, silicon oils, and put different chemicals, but the purity of the womb would have been gone. Mm-hmm. And so this kind of aspect of maintenance and kind of a life cycle, I think, is more interesting and better for the piece than if I would have created some type of kind of lie with the work.
And that is another fascinating feature that is so inherent in many of your works, which is this fascination with life cycle that you're describing. And I mean, I don't want to keep referring to this display upstairs, but those of you who've seen the contemporary hang upstairs, Jeff's piece is in the central room as you come in to your left, and in the back you see Bill Viola's stations, which is another sort of allegory to the life cycle. So there's a certain resonance here, perhaps, between those two pieces.
Joachim, when I worked here at the Modern, Bill Viola had a piece in the Projects Gallery, and it was so fantastic. I was probably about 20 years old, and he had a work that he had a video camera and then a copper tube, and water would, come to a drop and then go down through the image of the camera. You'd see it projected on a screen, and then it would drop on a tambourine and make a noise like boom. And I think it's been shown in a retrospective maybe 8 years ago or something. But this was the type of experience that I would have, that I would bring into my art then as a young artist, and kind of an understanding of what art could be. I would be around as a young artist Bill's work. Sorry to
No, this is perfect. But, no, thank you for that. So let's maybe look at...
what were you saying about
Bill?
Well,
about what I just thought there was a curious analogy, even though the works absolutely have nothing to do with each other formally, but this both you and Bill seem to have this fascination for the passage of life, the passage of time, this interest in the cycle of life in different ways. And I think that's something that comes through in your work, through this interest in childhood, and you mentioned also more maybe later on the development of an interest in mortality and the kind of finitude attached to the cycles of each work. So I saw that very much in the tank pieces, but I also see it in those this incredible couple of works, which I forgive me for saying this, but I think one museum, maybe us one day, should really have both of these works side by side. And they're just a wonderful couple. And they're talking about equilibrium here, even though this is a completely different world. To me, being born in France, this figure resonates very strongly. Louis XIV is responsible for not only, as Jeff was saying, amassing, accumulating maybe more art than perhaps any given monarch ever did. The building of the Palace of Versailles alone is just absolutely mind-boggling. But also this kind of quasi-insatiable greed, possession, voracious instinct for artworks. I mean, you know, the guy was surrounding himself with artists from all types, from everywhere, and just commissioning them to death, living in the red. I mean, just basically bankrupting the richest state, the richest country in the world. For what? For creating art, possessing art, you know. And as you said, the way there was a very much this notion that his artwork, his art commissioning, was a reflection on his own persona. And so to see this next to the great rabbit, the bunny, which you commented on so beautifully, and which is here, you know, 300 years later, the ultimate extreme opposite of this. This is the art that belongs to anybody, but nobody in particular. This is the art of the masses, the art of democracy, the art of the world we're in. And I think that within this you have this kind of spectrum. I mean, this is at least the way I see this couple, this kind of polarization that says so much about our history, but also about your work, because I think that you really play with this a lot. Or am I wrong here?
No, I think so. And Joachim, I think that also as an artist I strive to be in contact with archetypes. And, you know, sometimes people can think of archetypes as these strange Jungian type things. But I really think of archetypes or images or objects, things that really kind of help us survive. Mm-hmm. And so I think in some way, you know, the rabbit is an archetype. And whether it has to do about reproduction or just an object that can be very chameleon, you know, I don't know, but a kind of archetypal. And I always strive to do that in you know, all the works.
So I was also very very interested to since we're talking about the tradition of Western art, whom this figure in a way embodies in different ways. You are so obviously interested, more than interested, I mean, engaged, committed to the history of art, which you talk about it so often through so many different works, and it's not just the Renaissance Virgin Madonna tradition. It's you know, it's Duchamp, it's Manet, it's so many different things. And so, is this something that is a constituent a thread of inspiration throughout your work? Would you say from the beginning to today?
You know, I really enjoy art history, and I you know, I enjoy art. I remember when I first went to art school, and we went on a bus to the Baltimore Museum of Art, and we went in and we looked at the collection, and I realized that, you know, I really did not, you know, I didn't know what art was. I knew very little about it. I didn't know who Manet was. You know, I didn't know who Braque was. I may have known Cezanne and Picasso, and I knew Dali, but, you know, I really did not know about art history. And I survived that moment. And I think one of the reasons that, personally, I'm stayed about people embracing and accepting their own cultural history, it just has that, you know, art can be something which can debase you and disempower you. And I feel like I got through that and then had the understanding of the type of empowerment it could have. And I try to work with art history in a way that's non-intimidating, but just it just connects dots in a way of like a family history. Yeah. But the work never demands that you know anything before coming to it. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at the monkey train and think Thomas the Train, it's all right. You know.
So I'd like to see. I want to. Right, okay, this is perfect, yes. I'm talking about the other side of the coin. That is not Jeff making use in various ways of art history, but art history making use of Jeff's work. And this is, I want to refer to, I mean, there are many examples. What I'm trying to say is a little bit what I was alluding to earlier on, which is that Jeff's work has become so prominent on the art scene internationally, not just in this country, that it's become quasi-impossible for anyone to ignore him, including, which is really interesting here, this example, artists who are your father's generation, like Paul McCarthy, born at least 20 years before you, who suddenly looks at Jeff's works and says, okay, I've got to respond to this. I cannot let this happen without taking my own take, doing what you're doing to art history, doing it to yourself, you know, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, sure.
And so we've never talked about this. I mean, I actually happened to see, this is, by the way, Fucked Up Big Head by Paul McCarthy, on an absolutely obvious reference to Jeff's work, and maybe an ironic, I mean, anything McCarthy does is necessarily some way ironic, maybe debasing, and of course this is a little bit what you were talking about. But at the same time, this is the way I would see it. It's a great homage. I mean, it's a monumental piece. It's it's very big. I mean, it's almost half the height of this screen, and yet a direct comment on Jeff's presence in the art world and Jeff's work. So I don't know how you
see, I really like this piece. And it's made out of rubber. What's it made out of?
Yes, it's made out of, I think, styrofoam partly, and then it's cast in bronze. Yeah. I mean, in a way that you do as well. It's a two-piece. The platform is separated from the sculpture itself. I mean, it's very immensely heavy and very threatening in some ways, and you know, it seems to be about everything that could have gone wrong with Michael Jackson, but didn't go wrong with your piece. And
what's interesting, if you look at the leg, even in Paul's piece there, you see this kind of pyramid type shape, and I always thought that Michael Jackson also made reference, you could look at it in this tradition of Renaissance sculpture, but also the pharaohs of Egypt. And it's like King Tut, you know, this type of gold and decorative aspect. And so you have this kind of pyramid type shape. And I have this just hanging in a room at the studio. So sometimes I'm just looking at it and, you know, I thought I saw that. But I wouldn't expect a viewer really to pick up so much on that. Mm-hmm.
So I was also curious about, I mean, in the same line of inquiry, I mean, your work has been so central for, well, the people older than you and people younger than you, and the people in the 90s, nobody again could ignore what you've done. And I'm curious about whether you are, how do you feel about that? I mean, like one of our junior colleagues wanted me to ask you about your take on the role of the YBA school, who, you know, have been commenting in oblique ways about your work. And how do you see that? How did you come to grips with the 90s after what you had initiated in the 80s?
I just know in general that I've always enjoyed participating. And so when I was younger and starting to go to Europe and having an interaction with Martin Kippenberger and Albert Olin, even meeting Polk and different people, and then, you know, to also have an interaction with people like Damien Hirst and Sarah Lucas and the Chapman brothers. I mean, I enjoy this type of international interaction with artists. And I enjoy that dialogue. It's hard for me to speak about if there's any, if people look at the work and incorporate it in some manner. I think that, you know, it's exciting work going on, and I think it's an interesting community that really participates in, this dialogue of international work and connecting a generation and generations internationally, you know.
Again, goes back to this notion of communication and, with a viewer here, a very special type of viewer, an artist himself or herself. Let's look maybe at some... You brought up some recent works that you've been doing, but you've been so fecund again, and the metaphor of the egg is very pregnant with meaning here. I'd like to show you a few pieces that Jeff has produced in the recent years. This is Cracked Egg, a continuation, correct me again if I'm wrong, Jeff, of the Celebration series. And this, which has not been seen in this country, at least to my knowledge, you're looking at the corner of the Victoria and Albert Museum again. This is the red diamond, also part of the Celebration series. And this piece, which I don't think has been seen in this country. I don't know whether there's more than one example. This is the Hanging Heart, which is on view for those of you who are going to go to Venice for the Biennale. I don't know whether it will still be there, but I mean, it was in the Pino Foundation, the Palazzo.
Grazie.
Grazie. Thank you. Thank you very much. an amazing, amazing piece. Yeah. And I love actually the photograph shot that you have here with this kind of mystical aura, the light behind. You know, there's kind of some almost mystical aura to it.
The celebration work, I finished all these models for the works back in the 90s. I started in 94, and most of my models were finished by 98. Some of them I've still had to be completing today, but most of everything was finished. And celebration really deals with almost like a cyclical year. Hanging heart is almost like Valentine's Day. Cracked egg could be Easter. Diamond, I don't know, it could be an anniversary. Diamond's also a little bit like the egg being attacked by sperm, the way the posts are on it. But so it really dealt with kind of a cyclical year. Not every time, everything's so specific, but you can see a lot of references to different times of the year. The tulips we looked at earlier is like spring. And a balloon dog, I guess, would be like a birthday party. I don't know. Hmm.
So I wanted to ask you a question about your take on a lot of things, but I mean basically on the consumerist society, which has been, so much part of what you have been working with, or the corporate object that is recognizable, that is buyable, the commodity that we can acquire here and there, and the various things have been said about you on this subject. One, that you take it very much as matter of fact, very straight in the face, very seriously. There's no irony whatsoever. I personally have to say that I find it difficult to take that interpretation of your work, because very often I find myself laughing in front of your work. I think there's a huge amount of humor. Now, is it just me, or do you feel, how do you, what's your take on this particular aspect of your work?
You know, if I'm making something, I'm really just following my interests. Mm-hmm. And so I'm never sitting down in a very analytical way that, you know, I want to create this. Mm-hmm. But I'll really just follow my interests and focus on them. And, really kind of trust in that process. I find that I'm interested in how you feel chemically and, how things make your body feel. So if a certain intensity of a visual image. And so I have interest in that. So maybe desire and some of these things that we associate to consumerism really just has to do with in heightened states of the body, of feeling excitement and charge, something exciting, and feeling possibility.
The child opening a present as well, that sense of surprise and joy. The surface, yes. I mean, I find the polish. I mean, I don't know if you've seen some of Jeff's recent works, but this quality of a mirror surface, the polish aspect, I mean, it's just incredibly daunting. I mean, it's done so perfectly. I mean, the word perfection comes to mind, and I know you spare absolutely no effort. You and your studio assistants, and I mean, you are extremely demanding when it comes to that particular surface aspect that you are talking about.
But it has to be balanced, Joaquin, because craft for craft's sake is it's loss of energy. Hmm. And, you know, the best thing is really to get more energy out of something than's put into it. Mm-hmm. And so it's a delicate edge where, you know, you want to care for something because really what you care about is the viewer. And you're caring about just that they always feel as though you're kind of looking out for them, and you're presenting the best platform for this act of communication to take place. But if it's wasted energy, if something's labored over, it falls into fetishism, and it's not positive.
So there comes a point when you decide, okay, enough is enough. I've reached the point of near perfection, and that's it. I'm going to let it be available to the viewers? Or
I think I've learned to always accept that I fail. Mm-hmm. And I'll take something. I'm always trying to be as efficient as possible in creating something, in that I don't waste my energies and my facilities. Always to be sure that I'm working on what I want to be working on. Mm-hmm. And to be doing it as efficiently. I'm not talking economically. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking just of energy mm-hmm. in creating it.
That's fascinating.
So there is, I always want to make them better, and I don't want to, let something go through that isn't to everything that it can be, but I want to do that in the most efficient manner. Mm.
So I see that our colleagues from education are down there. So let's see. I was going to show these two pieces, but maybe let me just finish on. Oops. Lucas, I'm stuck. I cannot go back. Sorry. Just one back. I just want to mention. Thank you. Great. We're back at the very beginning. I see. Okay, this is Jeff's talk. Sorry. There will be a refresher.
You know, one of the reasons for the billboard, Made in Heaven, starring Jeff Koons and Cicciolina, after having the success of the Banality Show, I started to have an understanding that in American culture, you're not really participating or viewed as participating unless you're involved in film, medium. If you're involved with Hollywood, it's a sense that you're culturally participating politically. And so that was one of the reasons to at least create the illusion that I was working in film.
So maybe before we let you ask questions and answers, I just want to refer to this piece which pretty much blew my mind, Jeff, when I visited your studio last. And that is a model, as you can tell from the scale of the figures down there, a model for a major project, maybe your most ambitious project, wouldn't you say? I mean,
as far as scale and cost.
It makes Puppy look like a small thing almost. And this was going to happen in front of the Pinault Foundation when that project was going to occur in France, and it, of course, for political reasons, the French let that run away from them. So it is now at the Palazzo Grassi in Italy. And what's happened to this great project?
Michael Govan sold the piece here in New York, enjoyed it, and Eli Broad sold the piece. And so there started to become a dialogue about having the piece be at LACMA, Los Angeles County Art Museum. And so right at the present time, I've been working with them, and we have completed our second phase engineering. And it seems that they will move forward and actually produce the work. But, it's a very ambitious work as far as cost, and it's a big commitment to the museum. So I'm very excited about it. It seems like it will happen. I can't say for 100% that they will do it, but it looks like they're going to.
Very exciting.
It's 161 feet tall. The train engine weighs 500,000 pounds. It's not going to be a ready-made engine. It will be the 2903. The exterior will be absolutely, completely authentic. The train will run, and it'll run three times a day. It will start up on like a bell curve, going very, very slowly. And you always will feel that momentum, the acceleration going up, until 2.5 minutes later it's going full speed. It'll be very orgasmic, woo, 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 woo. And then the same bell curve down. It'll just start going slower and slower and slower until kind of these last kind of puffs, drippages of smoke come out. And, I always think of Times Square, the old camel guy. But it'll be completely authentic experience. An engineer from a train who worked on a train his whole life really would think that that's a real engine up there. How'd they do it? It's, pure high-pressure, low-pressure steam. And, I think I would enjoy it when I was a kid. It'll be 30 and a half feet from the ground, and you just walk right underneath it to enter the museum.
What wonderful way to conclude. This piece really embodies, I think, to me, your entire oeuvre, Jeff, in many ways, not You've heard about the sexual metaphors, the reference to childhood, nostalgia, and so many different things. So, anyway, I think that perhaps we are ready to take some of your questions, if you are interested, and maybe we could have a little more light with on the audience, perhaps. Thank you.
Hi. Both with the train and with the canon, it seems like a bit of a departure for you in that these are actually, there's an emphasis on them working and this authenticity. Could you speak to that?
I know that with the canon, I feel like I'm making a reference to the Baron Policeman sculpture and just about kind of a morality and having something very, very visceral. And at the same time, you know, something that can function, but it's really just the morality of, you know, whether somebody does use it or not. I mean, I'm going to use it and fire the cannon off that I have. If somebody has it, you know, they can fire it off. I guess this connection to the past has to deal just with morality and not morality, mortality, and just kind of my kind of coming to terms about a sense of my own mortality and my ambition to still do something. I mean, I want to participate and I'd really like to do something, and I'm just following my interest now with some of these historical objects that maintain a very visceral texture to them.
May I ask, I mean, just about this particular piece, which Jeff is referring to, the PC that just showed a black and white photograph of at the end?
The dictator.
The dictator. This was, is the present political, historical context, the Iraq war, was that have any impact at all in your decision to embark on this project? Or?
And I think it's impossible to function and not be aware of the environment you're in. So I guess the morality of having that and the type of control aspects that you have in society that you didn't have before in the past so much. I mean, I believe in gun control, but I still believe that it'd be nice to have a big cannon like this that you can fire off. But these things definitely come into play. I don't think the train would exist without the kind of the present day situation.
I just have a question on the luxury and degradation series. You mentioned that you started working with stainless steel as a reference. It has a proletariat quality. And so, is that a reference? Like, is it a Marxist proletariat?
The reference is just, I knew that I have no interest in money. And I mean, it's true. I have interest in being self-sufficient and being able to have a platform for my work and to be able to create my work and take care of my family. But I really don't have interest in money. I don't have interest in luxury, and I don't have interest, I don't understand it, and I don't understand its pursuit. I do understand the necessity to have a pot and pan to eat off of, and so if it was a form of Marxism or something, it just came from the air of life, not from getting involved in Marxist theory.
Well, I mean, using that material, and you said that it has that quality of being, I guess, proletariat, but then you said that you're trying to appeal to the middle class, for us to...
You know, at the same time, there was this seduction going on, so, you know, it was also making aware the ability of seduction and making it very reflective and intoxicating, and, you know, it's my art. I'm selling this now for a lot of money, and I wanted people to collect the art. So it kind of has this double kind of meaning, this double polarity that's taking place with it. But the message, though, for the art that you don't acquire, and you didn't have to acquire the work to get the message, was not to to pursue a luxury, to maintain one's economic power base, to sustain one's political power also. a lot of times in politics, people get so specific on issues, they make themselves unavailable for other political issues. They kind of disempower themselves that way.
Wouldn't you say that the people who are purchasing your work, I'm sorry, but wouldn't that be people who are gaining, I mean, who are expanding their wealth? And like the audience, basically, that you have is this kind of elite. So, you know, it's reinforcing the middle class, but yeah, it's still this elitism. You know.
I don't know if I understand completely, but there was kind of a panoramic view of society and showing that, you know, it's a wonderful thing about pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and expansion, but you have to be aware of how abstraction, how art can be used, in a debasing way instead of an uplifting way of, and so it was dealing with these different aspects that people have to be aware of in their journey in life and then their expansion of their selves in life. It doesn't mean don't expand.
There are other people who want to ask a question.
All right. Oh, this works. Okay. Jeff, I'm here.
Yes, hi.
I was wondering how familiar you are with Robert Smithson, probably a lot. Formally, the work doesn't match up really. Most of your work doesn't match up very well. But when he talks about his work, it's very, very similar in this kind of funny, monotone, deadpan kind of thing. I don't know if you've seen his film strips on the Yucatan, but that's what I'm thinking of specifically. And he just goes on and on about these complex and personal kind of meanings that the artwork has formed from his artwork and that other people can form from the artwork. And you probably missed him. I mean, he died a while ago, but I'm not sure if you read his writing and stuff. I'll give up my time.
Yeah, you know, I haven't read a lot of Robert Smithson's writings. I've been around his work. I love his work. I mean, my early inflatables are all really homage to Smithson and Judd. And, you know, his reflective piece is a pile of, like, rock salt or something with a mirror in. I mean, you know, this was the work that I was looking at. I enjoyed just how things were kind of just displayed and the simple abstraction of just the reflection and the involvement of the viewer and how it was happening inside you viewing it. So, you know, I love Smithson's work. Some of the films I'm not so familiar with, but, you know, I feel a tremendous homage to Smithson's work.
Hi there. I was wondering what sort of artwork you have in your home.
You know, it varies a little bit because I don't live with my own artwork at home. I have only one print of my work, which is stacked, which is a big pig and then a puppy, and a goat and then a puppy and another puppy and a bird on top. And the reason for that, I'm around my work every day, all day long, and I try to give my family a break from it. And I always want to just be dad and instead of, you know, this artist. And so we live with my wife's work, and we have Magritte, and we have Dali, and Roy Lichtenstein, H.C. Westerman, Ilsemius, Thomas Struth, Kippenberger, a whole variety of different works, Elizabeth Peyton, Albert Olin.
Is polka in them?
A polka, yeah, a polka. I have a nice polka, which it's like one of these Mad Magazine type of polkas. Mm-hmm. So.
I was just bringing polka up, because the most recent works you have used, I mean, the dot structure, I know you were referring to the cascade of water, different references, but it's difficult not to think about polka's works of the 70s.
Yeah. Polka, and you know, I really liked Roy Lichtenstein. Mm-hmm. I loved Roy. Mm-hmm. And when I started to have some success as an artist, the first thing I did, I ran out, and Leo Castelli let me acquire Roy's Surrealistic Head No. 2. And I was, you know, I loved it. I always loved Roy's sculpture. I remember seeing his show in 77 and just being knocked out of, you know, the sculpture, picture and picture, and, you know, the goldfish bowls and the lamps, these two-dimensional sculptures. And then I went through a divorce custody, and everything went. And then as soon as I had been able to get back on my feet again, the first thing I did was I got a large glass of Roy's. You know, so I love Roy's work. And I love Andy's work, too. Uh-huh. I met Andy only superficially twice and never really had any interaction with Andy.
It's something very beautiful that you say somewhere again. I'm sorry for quoting you constantly. I mean, I don't know the sources sometimes, but you mentioned somewhere in reference to Andy that you were hoping that you could appropriate some of the works, some like the Hoovers, I think the Hoover series, in the same sense that nowadays you see a Grillo box and you think immediately Warhol, you don't think Grillo box. This reminded me of an incredible quote by the poet, the symbolist poet Mallarmé, who writes to Monet, and he tells him, "I've just seen your exhibition of Haystack paintings, the series of Haystack paintings, you know." And he says, "You know what? Every time I go down in the countryside now, I cannot simply see a single haystack without thinking about your work." And this is like exactly the same kind of thing where the referent is sort of turned over. You know, so that nature does not count as much as its representation.
Yeah, that's great. Should we have more questions?
Just a short question, Jeff. What's your take on American copyright law? I know that you've had a few run-ins there, and because you're using so much material of other artists, and I think American copyright law is pretty restrictive in that regard. Would you like that to be changed, or is it hurting you, or is it better for others? What's your take on that?
Well, my involvement in copyright issues came really as a surprise to me because I never thought I was doing anything wrong. And I was always brought up on work like Picasso, using collage, cutting out images from newspapers and magazines and pop artists, incorporating things, you know, Rauschenberg and Johns and Andy and Roy and everybody, just working with kind of ready-made images. But when I did think that I was working with something, I should get permission, I would. I would seek permission. I'd wrote to Jim Beam or I'd write to all these companies to get the ads. But I got in the banality work, when they started to look at art, that it was about money and, you know, all these immoral artists just trying to collect money. And people involved with photography realized that there was some vulnerability to the art world here, that they could press them on copyright. I became a victim of that. And recently I just had a victory where I won a case. So the copyright law is changing in the way artists are using images, and this is also being viewed differently. But I did have cases, and I lost. I lost an MGM case with the Pink Panther, Odie, the dog, and Wild Boy and Puppy. I lost with String of Puppies. That was the one that was most known, the Art Rogers case. So today, for sure, I make special check on everything because I realize that, you know, people can come after you. But I've never, ever had anybody say no to me other than the liquor company, Old Granddad, back when I did Luxury Degradation. Mm. They were the only company that just said no.
Great question. Hi, I'm a big fan of your work, and one of the things I really love are all the different layers that come with it, and on the very top is the incredible sense of humor, and I love absurdism, and I was just interested in what your relationship with it is, if you feel like you have a really strong sense of humor, or if that's something that a lot of people come up to you and talk to you about, or what your reaction is, if work really, you think, wow, that's really a funny, absurdist work, and you really appreciate that in your work. And also, I guess my final kind of comment is that I feel like you really kind of objectively look outside of the art world, which I really appreciate. And I think that's what maybe perhaps gives you your freedom to be able to play with things in a way that often come out as really funny. And I was just kind of curious as to what your comment would be.
That's very nice. The first part, again, was of the question, because it was so nice. I was just thinking, this gentleman speaking so nicely about the work and looking at things. And
I guess you were saying about polarity, you know, that there's that there's these opposites. And
I remember the humor in the work and everything.
Yeah, and once I went into the Sonnenberg Gallery and I saw like a cartoon figure, and it was a mirror. And at one, I thought, gee, this artist is really kind of showing me my reflection, which I thought was almost a very cynical thing, but I kind of enjoyed that play. And then also celebrating joy with the shape. And I just got the feeling that you had this kind of remarkable distance, unlike a lot of artists, I feel like, who are so immersed in it, they're not fully conscious. And you're one of the few artists I feel like the work communicates to me that you're highly conscious of every layer of what you're doing.
I think just through art, art's been this vehicle that's been able to give me a sense of self. And from the time I was a child, and I know that it had to do with, you know, my parents would pat me on the back telling me I could draw better than my sister, who was older than I was. And it was this vehicle that started to give me a sense of self, and then start to be able to trust in myself. And I think it's this vehicle that maybe lets me have some distance to, it helps remove anxiety.
A sense of strength.
A sense of strength. And in this removal of anxiety, being able to look, I don't know if it's directly a humor, but I love Dada and I love surrealism. So, but you know, I never want to, I hope that when I die and I pass away, that the last conscious thought isn't like, oh my gosh, it's so clear right now. Why didn't I just do that? And so, you know, so it's to try to be there, you know, now, you know.
Thank you very much, Jeff. This is really wonderful.